Good afternoon and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Dr. Philippa Kelly and as Celia mentioned, I'm an educator, I am a dramaturg, I'm a passionate Shakespeare enthusiast, which is why I put together this theatre panel today. We also welcome our listening and internet audiences, and we invite everybody to join us online at www.commonwealthclub.org. Now, it's my pleasure to introduce the panel that I've put together today. Firstly, Asma Diaf, who is studying here. She's from Saudi Arabia, and she's doing a master's on technology and innovation. And beside Asma is William Brown III, and he is the artistic director of the fairly recently founded Arabian Shakespeare Company. And beside William is Taraj Yugosarian, who is actually a producer of a theatre company and is actually opening a production next week. And I really wanted her to have the chance to talk about that production and alert you to the fact that it's going on, and also to talk about what inspired the production. Taraj is an Iranian, and her mother is actually, Vida, is starring in this production. So we'll talk a little bit about that later. But in preparing for today, I did what is probably awful predilection of educators. I wrote a lecture, but I will just talk a little bit to part of the information that I put together. I wanted to begin by telling you a little bit about Shakespeare's dramas and their connection to the Arabic world. And so Palestine, Egypt and Morocco are three of the places that Shakespeare mentions. A number of the inhabitants of Arabic countries, like the Prince of Morocco in The Merchant of Venice and Queen Cleopatra of Egypt, feature in Shakespeare's plays. And a number of remarks have been made about the ways of life in the Arab world and also about the landscapes of this part of the globe. In Othello, Emilia says of a lady who's in love with Lodovico, who's a minor character in the play, "I knew a lady in Venice who would have walked barefoot to Palestine for a touch of his nether lip." And Othello himself, in his final beautiful soliloquy, refers to the Arabian trees which drop fast their medicinal gum. Well, it's interesting that in Othello, everything begins to fall apart when the characters enter the Arab world. So when everything moves from Venice to Cyprus at the beginning of the second act. In Macbeth, Arabia is seen as a land producing perfume, as the conscience-stricken Lady Macbeth says in her sleepwalking scene, "Not all the perfumes of Arabia will sweeten this little hand." In The Merchant of Venice, the Prince of Morocco, as I mentioned before, refers to the vasty wilds of wide Arabia, Egypt, a land of charms. "That handkerchief did an Egyptian to my mother give. She was a charmer." I'm sorry, this actually line is from Othello. "And could almost read the thoughts of people." In Antony and Cleopatra, Egypt is associated with perfumes as well, with wealth and munificence. And I mentioned before the Prince of Morocco, he mentions his black complexion and he also mentions judging people by their external appearances. He considers himself to be inferior to white people And he starts explaining why his complexion is so black. He says, I've been too long in the sun, but don't judge me for that. So it's interesting that Shakespeare brings all of these kind of preconceptions into the way that he's putting his drama together. And he really is like a magpie picking up coloured bits of glass and holding them up to the light. We'll talk about that a little bit more later. Shakespeare also refers to the Turkish carpets as bring me that piece of gold beneath the Turkish carpet. That's a sign of wealth and munificence that he associates with the Arab world. And of course, most of you probably know that the term alchemy comes from al-chem, which actually describes Egypt. It was the ancient name for Egypt. So it's interesting that alchemy is such an important part of Shakespeare's thinking and dramatic works. As a dramatist, he focused almost exclusively on European subject matter and major characters. The earliest performance, with just those little notes, that grace notes that I mentioned before, the earliest performance of a Shakespeare play in the Middle East occurred at quite an early date in 1608. But no subsequent performance tradition emerged for quite a long time, in part through Islamic repression of theatrical representation. A few translations of Shakespeare began to circulate in the Arab world from the beginning of the 19th century, and Shakespeare entered the Egyptian theatre in versions derived from French translations that were done in the 19th century. But it's really been the processes of globalisation that have brought Shakespeare as more of a discursive part of the Middle East in the last couple of decades. Celia asked me to mention that quite recently, at the end of last year, one of the world's major scholars, Stephen Greenblatt, was asked to be the keynote speaker at a newly organised Shakespeare conference in Tehran. He wrote up his experience in the New York Review of Books. He then got a vitriolic attack in print by one of the organisers of the conference. And I mention that here because it's so interesting to me that Shakespeare becomes not just, I mentioned before, the dramatist who picks up the pieces of coloured glass and holds them up to the light and makes them part of his dramatic situation, but he himself has become quite a part of public debate, public confrontation between different parts of the Middle East. And of course, the play that you'd imagine has been most associated with this is actually The Merchant of Venice, where there was an Arab translation done of the play in earlier in the 20th century, and Arab thinking about the play was that Shylock represents all of the characteristics of Jewish people that they most take opposition to. So that play has quite a history. Before I move to my panel, I do want to say here we have Banashay Kenuth, who is leading a reading group on Monday at 5:30 p.m. She is just an amazing thinker, and I'm honoured that you are here. She's translated for four Iranian presidents, and is one of the most modest people I know, which is why I've had to introduce her myself into my talk about theatre in the Arab world. Now I will move to questions for the panel and the next part of our process. So I want to begin with William. I want to ask you how you began the Arabian Shakespeare Festival, and how it has grown, and what you envisage, your inspiration, and what you envisage for its future.
We began back in actually 2007 was when the idea was formed. It began as just a conversation I was having with my family. Boy, wouldn't it be great if we could do Othello in the Middle East? And my father, who was living in the United Arab Emirates at the time, said, well, you know, they're building up an island called Saadiyat Island for the arts specifically, so maybe this isn't a pipe dream. And that's what started us. And we spent 3 years working on trying to take productions of Shakespeare from America to perform in Abu Dhabi, and we're going to pair that with an education program for the local Emirati youth. And I point out Emirati because in the Emirates, I don't have the exact number, but it's something like 70% expats to locals. And that is the audience for all the artistic endeavors that the Emirates brings in, for the most part, is the expats. So we wanted to build up something for the locals. And we spent 3 years working on that, and it fell through at the last minute. However, it did lead to a gentleman named Jim Marioni, who ran the theater program at UAE University in Al Ain, to get in touch with us and say, I have a small budget for the arts. What can you do? And we put together a program of three actors, myself, Aldo Billingsley, and Anna Marie McLeod. And we went to the UAE and spent 2 weeks working with the women of UAE University on their women's campus, just doing scenes from Shakespeare and how that connected to various concepts of theater. And at the end, we put on a performance. And we invited the women to join us on stage if they wanted to. And we had about 13 women did this. And we put out, and I'll never forget this, 75 chairs. And it was open to the public, the audience. And we thought, if we get 35 people out there, that's a huge win. 400 women showed up. And we had to stop for call to prayer. And about 200 left. And they came back afterwards, and we continued on. And that led us to come again the next year. This time, Aldo Billingsley directed, and a woman named Jennifer LeBlanc joined us, and we did a bridge production of Midsummer Night's Dream and an abridged production of The Merry Wives of Windsor, and performed those again at the end, invited the women to join us, and again had 300 to 400 people were there. And that's what launched us into, okay, there's something here. Shakespeare speaks to these women in the Middle East, some of which were coming from the very far Emirates, the very conservative ones. And there's something to this. And so that's what led us to form the company, Arabian Shakespeare Festival, in 2013, legally as an organization. And now our mission is to really create a cultural bridge between America and the Middle East, to really break down the stereotypes and myths that exist about Arabs here in America. Because if you turn on the news, sometimes you would think it's one gigantic evil country of Middle East, which is so far from being true. And so we bring Arab stories here and perform them in San Francisco that speak to the same issues of humanism that are so beautifully presented in Shakespeare. And we perform Shakespeare's plays that directly speak to social issues that are important in the Middle East. Currently, we focus on Kuwait, because that's where we're very close to working right now. And we perform both of those. And that's really what started us and has kept us going. And in the future, we are working towards every year doing an Arab story and a Shakespeare production here. And our goal with every production is it is able to travel. We are working very hard at taking our productions to Kuwait and performing them there as well. And we are close to our production this fall going back to Kuwait as well. But I get to talk about that production a little later, so I'll stop there for the moment.
So just so you know, William's next production is We Made Bread with one actress. It's a one-woman show, but get to that a little later. I just wanted to say, Asma, I was wondering how... So basically, Asma is Saudi. I think William has not been to Saudi Arabia. But I'm wondering, in view of what William has been saying about theatre, the Middle East, public representations, how does that ring to your ear? Do you find that that people have a very generalised and narrow perspectives of who you are and what you're doing here?
Okay, so first, just to give like introduction, first of all, I would like to speak about theater and education because there is considered an important part of education. So first of all, let's take a look at theater in schools. School theater was the first beginning of theater in the country. Is it still not? Okay. Okay, thank you. Being in education field, I saw how educators were very keen, more than others, to honor students' achievement in theater. And of course, for educational outcomes, theater is a good strategy to improve reading and speaking fluency. So that is for school. In higher education, each university has its own theater. And these universities promote theater by providing financial and technical support. However, it is still practiced less than in schools. Outside the school, I would say that the idea of using theater to educate upcoming generation is more desirable for most people. So the real theater was built for children mostly. For example, there is a huge annual competition for children theater. In addition, there are awards for the best promising performers and playwriters, the best decoration, theater's decoration and music. So we can see clearly how children's theater is active more than others. Yeah.
So then children's theatre is more invested in than theatre for older people. Do you think that's partly because of the shift in that so much is shifting in the schools and it's probably moving less quickly?
I would say yes, yes. Yeah, they want to, you know... educate, you know, sometimes it's just like there are some restrictions on theater, so they would try to, you know, at least try to educate upcoming generations and concentrate on them more than adults theater.
And so then just to go to one of the things that William brought up, how do you feel about, so you're here studying, does his, when William mentions, you know, the people's view of this vast blob of the Middle East that has a particular attitude toward religion or toward women, do you feel that it's something that you've had to change people's perspectives one by one, or are people more informed about the Middle East than one might have expected? I don't know the answer to the question. I'm just wondering. So it's not a setup. It's a real question.
Is that for me? Okay. No, I was listening. I was like, oh, it's a good question. Well, first of all, I would like to mention that theater in Saudi Arabia faced some challenges, and that's because some extremists from different parts of the world wanted to keep the country as a spiritual place to do only religious activities. Thankfully, education has survived without paying attention to these extremist negative thoughts. However, the celebrations are still there in education and in theater, which is also considered a part of education there. This separation didn't really affect the quality of education, but it definitely created a gap in theater such that both genders don't perform together on the same stage. And that makes it very selective theater. Some women find it more convenient to have their own theater and to deal with their own issues. Even though I don't think you see this separation in media, women and men present together on the TV all time. And they also perform together in international theaters, but not in local theaters.
Mm-hmm. That's very interesting. You know what's fascinating for me as a Shakespearean? The division between the theatre and religion was very much alive at the beginning of the 17th century, where the Puritans did everything possible to get the theatre shut down, and in fact did get the theatre shut down. Mm-hmm. Malvolio in Twelfth Night is Shakespeare's parody of a Puritan. So religious fundamentalism really was in battle with the theatre.
Exactly, yeah.
When you came to study here, did you find that people expected you to have certain attitudes about gender or about education?
Well, there's always a stereotype about Middle East generally, not only in Saudi. But the most interesting thing that people don't know about is they think that our education is really limited just because we are a religious country, but that's not true. Actually, education there is really, really good. Even professors, sometimes when I discuss with them, they would be only surprised that I have that kind of knowledge which is matching education here. So, it's mostly, you know, that is the thing always we face. But we have to correct all these misunderstandings about Middle East. Yeah,
it's one of the things I think is amazing about the internet. In a sense, you think of, say, that the beginnings of say women's education in Saudi Arabia, which is only a few decades ago, but with the world of the internet, we have all grown together, and so in a sense, the internet has been a great equalizer for so many forms of education.
Well, it also depends on a person that I meet. If the person is, you know, listening to the media so much, mostly old people, so they would have some kind of negative stereotype. But most young people don't really have that negative stereotype, and that's because they have social media and they communicate with young people, and they know that we're just the same.
Yeah.
So that is a point that I wanted to mention.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And social media, I think, really does unite
great
people
job.
In astonishing ways. Can I just move across to Taranj? It's amazing to have Taranj here today, and I'll tell you why, for a couple of reasons. One is that she's actually putting on a play in a week's time. Usually you can never get a playwright here when it's their own work, you know, coming in such a short time. I'm so grateful that you've taken this time off to be with us. The second thing is that Taranj is Iranian, and her mother, Vida, is starring in this play. And I thought, even though it's not Shakespeare, I thought actually all the more reason to expand this to talk a little bit about Taranj's perspective of theatre from her view of the Middle East.
Good afternoon. Thank you so much, Philippa, for the invitation and for sort of fitting me in into your program this afternoon. So our production, as Philippa mentioned, is Esfahan Blues, and the postcards are at the door. Let me begin by explaining that I'm actually the founding artistic director of Golden Thread Productions, a theater company focused on the Middle East. We were founded in 1996, and in many ways we began our work with the mission of building cultural bridges between the U.S. and the Middle East. And we would define the Middle East broadly and inclusively, and it's not limited by geographic or political divisions. So we've produced plays from around the world as long as they are related to the Middle East in one way or another. Another connection that Esfahan Blues has to today's conversation is that it's a co-production with African American Shakespeare Company. The story of the play is inspired by Duke Ellington Orchestra's tour to Iran in 1963. That year happens to be the same year that my parents in Tehran opened a nightclub. And in my overactive mind, I imagine, and as Philippa mentioned, my mother was a film star in Iran in the 60s, 50s and 60s. So the story imagines a meeting between a jazz musician from Duke Ellington Orchestra and my mother at the nightclub. And that's how it begins. And then they go on a journey to Esfahan together and all hell breaks loose. So do come to see Esfahan Blues. And just bringing the conversation back to theater in the Middle East, so I have to say that obviously, as we all know, Middle East is quite diverse. So it's one thing to speak about Saudi Arabia or the Gulf region, but when we look at countries like Tunis or Egypt or Iran, there is a long tradition of theater. It's quite active. There are ongoing festivals, and there is a huge adoration of Shakespeare, particularly his more political plays, such as Richard III or Macbeth. Those are continuously adapted and produced directly and indirectly pointing to political concerns in the various countries. And Hamlet. I mean, as the younger generation in countries such as, I just want to focus on Tunis, Egypt, and Iran, where the political turmoil is so at boiling point, I would say, the younger generation is really looking to the arts to communicate its concerns in a more deeper cultural way rather than through political leadership, frankly, because they've lost faith in political leaders and they're fed up with leadership that doesn't really represent the concerns of the people. And I think we all see that every day in the news, what's happening in those countries. So a play like Richard III, for example, last year in Tehran alone had 16 different adaptations. So that is an amazing phenomenon. And why is it that Shakespeare is so accessible and so popular in a country like Iran or in Egypt, where when the annual experimental theater festival was happening in Cairo, every year you would see multiple adaptations of various Shakespeare plays. I mean, it's accessible, it's respected globally. In many ways, Shakespeare's plays are inspired by or impacted by stories from the Middle East, stories from 1001 Nights, or traditions. If we look back to 15th, 16th century, the connection between the Middle East and Europe was very tight. I mean, there was a lot of exchange, whether it's the Ottoman Empire or the Persian Empire or the the merchants traveling in Andalusia or Silk Road. These stories traveled around the world, and artists were influenced by these stories. So there's a lot within Shakespearean plots, characters, and plays that speak to the people in the Middle East, and you can make direct links to stories that are well known in the Middle East. Mm-hmm. Another reason why Shakespeare is popular has to do with the censors. Sometimes when playwrights propose an original work that the censors deem political, it's easier to shut that down. But if you propose Hamlet and the censors say, no, Hamlet is not acceptable, you know, say, come on, what do you mean Hamlet is not acceptable? Everybody is producing Hamlet all over the world. So in a way, through Shakespeare, there's license for saying things that perhaps original new work is less able to say.
Taranj, when you say adaptations, do you mean translations or...?
No, I mean adaptations. Yeah. I mean Iranian versions of Hamlet.
Yeah.
Most recently, there was a solo piece named Hamlet, Prince of Grief, that was touring in the U.S., and that's directly from Iran. And it's basically one man sitting at his desk reviewing Hamlet and making connections between his own life situation and what Hamlet went through.
So these adaptations, they're normally done in English?
They're all done in the original language, whether it's Arabic or Persian.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, that's what I wanted to check out. That's fascinating, yeah.
And I'd like to jump in on that, the adaptations. Kuwait has an international theater festival every year, and it happens in December, and I happened to be in Kuwait while it was going on, and I got the privilege of being invited to a rehearsal for a show that was about to open up, which was a new work based on Othello. I certainly don't have the Arabic to pick up everything that was being said, but as I was watching, this is when we were producing Othello, I just finished producing Othello here in San Francisco, and as I was watching, and this was before I knew it had anything to do with Othello, I was like, wow, that's Othello. I wonder if they know that. Of course, I spoke to the playwright, and he knew that. And at the same trip, I was invited to a rehearsal of Macbeth, which was translated into Arabic and was being performed as well. And I was happy to hear that Taranj speak about Macbeth, because I think I have been sent emails from various people in Kuwait about 7 or 8 different productions of Macbeth going on. There is just very popular, and sometimes adapted, and sometimes just with their own culture and sensibilities put onto it.
You know what's sort of fascinating about this is does anybody know the one Shakespeare play that is not plot-wise lifted? Anybody know the one play?
Merry
Wives. No, Midsummer Night's Dream. Everything else, the plot is borrowed. So it's really interesting when we start to talk about adaptations of Shakespeare, because he was the world's great adapter. And even Midsummer has, for a Shakespearean, you can trace 4 different plot sources, but they're just not so heavily implicated. Some interesting questions here. What does a dramaturg do? I'm a dramaturg. I'll tell you a little more about that. If you go to the California Shakespeare Theatre site, have a look at, or you can Google, and I didn't set this up myself, it had cause to be set up for me, Ask Philippa! I'll put more about what a dramaturg does on the site so I don't chew up all the time now. But basically, a dramaturg is a role that began as a sort of a curatorship of theatre. So how to keep Shakespeare's plays textually intact. Over the last decades, dramaturgy has grown into quite an integral process of the creation of a work for the theatre. It can involve adaptation, annotation, translating what the lines mean, giving context. For every production I work on, I write an actor packet for the actors, cast and crew, any information I think might be interesting. For instance, you might look at, say, Romeo and Juliet, and I might tell you how Verona was seen in Shakespeare's time. It was very hot, therefore the assumption was that the young men would be hot-blooded and red-blooded. So that would, and then the marriage age of people in England as compared to Italy. Just one interesting little point here, Romeo and Juliet, well, basically Shakespeare stages, I think, 103 scenes in his oeuvre that are based in Verona. He stages no scene that I can think of except for Cyprus in the Middle East. And the reason is he was a really smart playwright. You write about what you know. And he had very strong connections with Europe, and much more exoticized connections with the Middle East. So that's sort of interesting to see how that emerges in his work. But more on what a dramaturg does will appear tomorrow on the Ask Philippa site. Does learning about Shakespeare, where Shakespeare originated, help inspire your passion? That feels like, let's give that question to William.
And sorry, I missed the
does,
question.
Does learning about where Shakespeare originated help inspire your passion?
It did originally. I developed my passion for Shakespeare when I was in college. I got the opportunity to study at the Globe Theatre in London for a summer. And I went into it after having not the best experience with Shakespeare in high school. Which is a very, I see many people laughing out there. It's apparently a very common thing, which there's many organizations working to fix that as we speak. But that really inspired me as to, oh, this isn't just some old dead guy. These works are relevant. They are speaking to me now, you know, 400 years later. What inspires me now, however, is seeing how these plays are still true, and not just true to me here in San Francisco. I go to Kuwait, and I just had the pleasure of leading a workshop there that was open to the public, so I had no idea who was going to come. And we talked about a speech from the end of The Taming of the Shrew, which is Kate's famous speech about how you should behave as a married woman, and is very controversial here. And the question is, oh, is she being serious? Is she, you know, is this tongue-in-cheek? And we can debate that all day. And a scene from Romeo and Juliet where Juliet's father has said, you're going to marry Paris tomorrow, and she doesn't want to, and he says, fine, go die in the streets, I'll have nothing to do with you. And we spent an hour talking about these scenes, and the people there in the workshop, some were saying, were just adamant, no, Kate can't be serious, this doesn't happen, no one thinks that way. And across the circle, another woman would say, actually, my friend thinks like that. And then someone would say, oh, didn't you read in the newspaper this week about this story? It's the same thing. And in this span of about 10 seconds, we had six different news stories from the past week, how they related. And the beautiful thing that happened at the end of this, we were talking about Romeo and Juliet, and what happens in that scene is Juliet's mother just does what the father says in the end. And they came to the conclusion, because they couldn't figure out what kind of woman would seriously say Kate's speech, if you must obey your husband and listen to what he says, and they said, that woman would do it. Juliet's mother would do that. And they all said, we know someone like that. And that's inspiring to me, that they made those conclusions. They got there and said that, you know, we could put this on stage and we could talk about women's roles in society. We could talk about the parent-child relationship and could start a conversation. That's what inspires me now.
That's wonderful. And just to address the specifics of the question, does learning about where Shakespeare originated inspire your passion? A few tiny little things. Shakespeare was born in 1564. In the first 3 months of his life, the plague swept through Stratford, where he was. Three infants in his street died, and he survived. So there's almost an air of kind of mysterious celebration, even in his very early years. He was the third child of his parents, the first to survive. So that brings to you the sense of how high infant mortality was in that time. He went to school at quite an upper-class school because his father was a town councilman, but he was forced to leave school at the age of 14. He was then really an autodidact for a number of years. We don't exactly know what he did, except that he resurfaced at the age of 18, marrying a woman of 26 because he got her pregnant. The issue of that marriage, Susanna, became his favorite child. He had two children, twins, after that, Judith and Hamnet. Hamnet died at the age of 11. Judith survived. She always displeased her father. And so you look at Shakespeare's oeuvre, his works, they're all, well, not all, but many of them are centered on a father's displeasure with her daughter and a means of reconciliation toward the end of his life with that daughter. I don't think he ever achieved that with Judith. In fact, he cut her pretty much out of his will 3 months before he died. But he was very much fascinated by that topic. So for me, I began my life as a Shakespearean, or my working life as a Shakespearean. As I've gone further, I tend to cross-stitch back across my knowledge with aspects of Shakespeare's life that may be used to inform that knowledge, but one can never explain it, say, oh, he did this because of this that happened in his life. But it is fascinating to see, say, the cross-hatching in his own life of the relationship between fathers and daughters and the completely different relationships he had with both his daughters. So I can put more of that on the web. Somebody asked, in what play is The Turkish Carpet referred to? Comedy of Errors. Bring me that gold ingot beneath the Turkish carpet. Do the comedies appeal as much in the Middle East as the plays refer? That's a great question. Do the comedies appeal as much as Macbeth? Well, Richard III has a very comic element. Also, you may not know that The Merchant of Venice, which is hugely popular in the Middle East, was actually first written as a comedy. So do what you will with that. But William, are you asked to put on tragedies or comedies?
I think a lot of it has to do with the group, well, the audience in many respects. When we were in the Emirates, what we actually got the most discussion from was a scene from Midsummer Night's Dream, the very first scene of the play, which for anyone who doesn't know, long and short, Hermia doesn't want to marry the fellow that Dad wants her to marry, and then from that we have a play. Usually you do that here, and you can't be done with that scene fast enough. Yeah, everyone thinks, okay, let's make with the funny. But there, we spent 2 weeks doing that scene and discussing it. And it was an incredible thing happened was we would ask these women, you know, well, what's going to happen? And having never read this play, they predicted the entire play, with the exception of the fairies. They didn't come up with that. But they predicted the whole play, and they would talk about, we asked them, well, what would you do? And they would talk about their friends that ran away to Canada and got married there. And so I think, to answer the question, I think there's place for all of it. I think the comedies are an easier entry in many, many ways. And you can pull chunks out of a comedy, I think, easier than you can pull a chunk out of, you know, a great tragedy. But I think all of them have a way of speaking to what's going on. There, and it's just a matter of recognizing that as you're doing it and being open to listen to what they're saying.
Talking about pulling chunks out of a comedy, I believe Asma has a chunk of a tragedy to pull out for you.
Well, first of all, talking about comedy, I would say it's the most appealing theme, maybe. It's just because the political situations there is kind of sad. So people would try to go, you know, to something maybe entertaining. like comedy. You know, comedy is a great way as a therapy, maybe. So that's for the question. For others, what was your question? Sorry, again.
We talked about to be or not to be.
Oh, well, that is really... That's really touching because I still remember a story happened to me when I was helping my friend. She was studying English literature, and she was performing a passage in Hamlet. And we were just like trying to help each other. And when we arrived to the most famous line, to be or not to be, many, many inner conflicts came to our minds about life, death, religion. So there are really several fundamental questions and answers of philosophy in many plays, and that really helps us to you know, understand the nature of human beings and all kinds of struggle that they go through. So yeah, it's just a great way.
Yeah. It's interesting, isn't it, thinking about how people see theatre. I think from what you're suggesting, mm-hmm. theatre is often represented as a diversion, and I imagine that Shakespeare is so often funded because people can say, this is established theatre, this is Shakespeare. So then you get the possibility to do Shakespeare, and then you have all of the wonderfully subversive ideas and language that thread through those plays in often unexpected ways. Taraj, when you were writing, forgive my pronunciation, if Afghanistan Blues, have I said that?
Isfahan Blues.
Isfahan Blues. Sorry, that I knew I had it wrong. When you were writing it, because it's quite a humorous script to me in many respects, the way Bella speaks back to Ray. Uh-huh. How long did it take you to write, and what was your motivation?
Well, the process began in 2012. Let's see, there were two motivations. One was I'm a jazz lover, I'm a huge Ellington fan, and I've known about the Far East Suite album for many, many years. I own several different versions of it, and there's a song on that album called Esfahan. So I was always curious what might have happened to the orchestra to inspire them to name a song after that city. So that was one thing that was sort of percolating in my mind. And another thing is, you know, my mother had an amazing film career in Iran, and she continues to be an amazing actor now, even though she's nearly 80. And I felt that I really was looking for an opportunity to pay tribute to her career and really feature her on stage, you know, before too long. So those two came together beautifully in this story, and when Peter Callender, who is an amazing local actor, took over African American Shakes, I sort of pitched the idea to him. He was very receptive to it. At the time, it was a question whether Duke Ellington would actually be a character in the play or not. Later, we found that the song Esfahan was actually written by Billy Strayhorn and not Ellington. So we decided to focus on Billy Strayhorn's life, and he is an amazing character, very complicated, very sort of inward. There's a beautiful biography of him. If you haven't read it, do look it up, Lush Life. And so I focused on bringing together my mother's life experience with Billy Strayhorn. And Billy Strayhorn had a very deep friendship with Lena Horne, who was a singer and an actress. And so that friendship inspired the friendship that develops between Bella and Ray in our play. So really rich, sort of fertile ground for the story. And then it's been in development for nearly 3 years. and has had two workshops and now a world premiere. I think it needs another two or three productions before it fully gels.
I can't wait to see. It's the 2nd of May, isn't it?
Yes, 2nd of May is our opening, so please come.
One thing that I'm thinking about at the age of nearly 80 and Taranja's mom, Vida, Laurence Olivier said about the character of Lear, the problem is that when it's appropriate for you to play it, you're Lear in every part of your body and you can't do it. The youngest Lear ever played was Sir John Gielgud when he was 27. Most people end up doing their hallmark Lear in their 50s, maybe their 60s. But it is fascinating to think Taranja's mom is almost 80. She's got a lot of lines in this play.
We're all very nervous.
But what an amazing achievement, something that, you know, Shakespearean actors often flee from as they age. It's really thrilling to think that this is happening. It's going to be an honor to see this play.
Yeah, we all feel privileged to be in her presence, and she's such a joy to work with. And, you know, she's very opinionated, but also a joy to work with. So we are all learning a lot from her.
Well, everyone, it's 2 minutes to one. I feel as if I have shockingly predominated in this panel when I've actually got such terrific thinkers and speakers here. But I will close in a second. I will say, if you want to know more about Taranja's production, please get the cards as you go out and look her up online. Williams?
Can I make a quick pitch about the show this fall?
Please, yes. We Made Bread is coming up.
And I quickly just asked her if I could speak to it. What we're doing this fall, it'll be November 12 to 22. It's a world premiere one-woman play about... created from first-person interviews with women of Kuwait who survived the Iraqi occupation and were in the country. Most of the country was gone during that time. And it's the stories of how they resisted, how they held on to their own, to their families, and into their country. And it's simple, very simple things that they would do just to feel like they had control, up to one woman who... her son was captured very early on the first day. She didn't know where he was. And she tricked her way into convincing an officer, an Iraqi officer, that she was actually Iraqi, and therefore her son was actually Iraqi. So therefore she should be allowed to take him off the prison bus. He gave her an order that said she could. And every day or every week, she went onto a prison bus, found a young man and said, "You love me, you're my son," and took him off the bus. At risk of her life. And it's... these are stories no one knows these stories, and it completely shatters the idea that so many people have of what an Arab woman is, what a Muslim woman is. And we are blessed to have a woman named Nadia Ahmad, a Kuwaiti actress, coming to perform that for us.
Wonderful. And could I have Asma say a closing word?
Okay, just like the last point, it's also worth knowing that concentrating on theater or having a theater for young people is really helpful. It could be also a way to introduce democracy, and that's when audience listen to different sides of conversation or arguments. So that's really important, especially in this critical time in the Middle East. Yeah.
Thank you, Asma. We'd like to remind our listening audiences that this is a Commonwealth Club program called Arabian Shakespeare. Unfortunately, we're pretty much done with our time. Thank you so much to our beautiful panelists today for coming. Also thank our audiences, those listening to the recording and those on the internet. I'd like to remind you that at 5:30 on Monday, Banafshe is leading a fabulous reading group, which I intend to come to. I'm Dr. Philippa Kelly, your moderator for today's program, Arabian Shakespeare. Now, this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating over 110 years of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.